I'm able to take a bath or a shower, and I'm able to lock the door. I'm not afraid to go to bed anymore.
Sobering up at Karluk Manor in Anchorage. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, February 9th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, a futuristic version of Tlingit Regalia.
Would it be programmable? Would the colors get brighter as the drums got louder and the singing got louder?
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
BP, supporting public broadcasting in Alaska.
And by Bristol Bay Native Corporation, generations of jobs, heritage, and history. Bristol Bay, a place that's always been. Online at bbnc.net.
The decline of the western stock of Steller sea lions has been a source of controversy for more than two decades. Now there's a new development in a lawsuit that pits the state of Alaska, fishing industry groups, and Aleut Enterprise against the National Marine Fisheries Service. KUCB's Alexandra Gutierrez reports.
The National Marine Fisheries Service is asking for at least 15 months to assess the impact of their Steller sea lion protection measures. Last month, a federal judge determined that the agency had violated the National Environmental Policy Act, or NEPA, by failing to produce an impact statement before shutting down two commercial fisheries in an effort to stop the decline of an endangered stock of sea lions. While Judge Timothy Burgess generally favored NIMS in his ruling and stated that he plans to keep the fishing restrictions in place, he still called upon the agency to review the effects of the closures as quickly as possible. In a brief filed yesterday, NIMS gave the court two potential timelines for doing so. The agency says that it could complete an environmental impact statement no earlier than June of next year, and that public participation would be somewhat limited on a timeline that rushed. NIMS is instead arguing for a timeline of 23 months. That would allow the agency to coordinate with the North Pacific Fishery Management Council and ideally release their findings in March of 2014, pending any delays. Gretchen Harrington is a policy coordinator for NIMS. She says that the review will give the agency a chance to analyze the social and economic impacts of the closures of the Atka mackerel and Pacific cod fisheries in the Western Aleutians.
That requires an analysis of the impacts on the human environment. So that is understood to mean not only the natural environment, but also the people and communities that could be affected by the action.
It's unclear when Judge Burgess will issue his final order on the environmental impact statement, but NIMS spokesperson Julie Spiegel says that the agency would like the decision to come sooner rather than later.
We're hoping in the next couple weeks, but again, that's up to the judge.
Meanwhile, the state of Alaska, a plaintiff in the lawsuit, indicated in a separate brief that it would like the statement to be completed a little bit earlier than NIMS is proposing. It wants a timeline that would maximize involvement from stakeholders while still potentially allowing for the reopening of the mackerel and cod fisheries by 2014. Those fisheries are estimated to bring in over $80 million a year in revenue for the industry. Doug Vincent Lang is the acting director of the Division of Wildlife Conservation, and he thinks that NIMS can have the review done within 18 months.
I don't think it's fair to ask the communities and the fishermen to wait that long to resolve this problem. So I think we tried to find a middle ground where the problem gets resolved with adequate time, in our opinion, to get council engagement and public engagement, but doesn't proceed so long that in essence you end up with what the court determined to be a invalid NEPA process.
Right now, NIMS scientists are preparing for a March trip to do more research into the health of the Steller sea lion population. There's still no established consensus on why the stock is shrinking, though a biological opinion released by NIMS suggests that competition from commercial fishing vessels may be affecting sea lion diet. In Unalaska, I'm Alexander Gutierrez.
Courts on the Kenai Peninsula and in Fairbanks have recently ruled that an existing law forbidding drivers from looking at devices with screens, such as computers and DVD players, does not forbid a driver from using a cell phone to send a text message. Lawmakers are afraid that legal opinion will spread to other jurisdictions and are talking up a bill that would make certain that texting while driving is not legal. The House Judiciary Committee yesterday heard a bill on the matter. The bill by Anchorage Democrat Les Guerra would specifically define and forbid texting by a driver while the vehicle is moving. Guerra told the committee that texting is the new drunk driving.
If you text a normal-sized text message while you're driving, you'll drive the length of a football field before you're done. You'll drive the length of a football field of potential victims before you're done sending your text message.
Committee Chairman Carl Gatto is a co-sponsor of the bill. He says it would be dangerous to delay action on the subject.
This bill fails. The word goes on the street that texting is okay. All our expert from 8 to 80 who are very good are going to start texting. Because if they were somewhat reluctant to text, once we tell them it's okay, they'll do it.
Guerra agrees, saying he believes the Supreme Court will eventually overturn the lower court rulings. However, the legal process could take as long as 3 years. He says it will be better to go ahead and put the law on the books rather than wait that long. Recent studies show that housing street alcoholics is cheaper than letting them fend for themselves. But a new study shows that's not the only benefit. They're finding that tenants also drink less. KSKA's Daisha Eaton takes us inside Carluck Manor in Anchorage, where we meet one tenant who has already stopped drinking and is trying to turn her life around.
At the corner of 4th and Carluck, the gray building formerly known as the Red Roof Inn is home to 46 chronic inebriates. Since it opened in December, two tenants have died. But managers say that's to be expected after the stressful years they've spent on the streets. Melinda Freeman manages Carluck.
Having a place to live transforms lives, and that's what we are here for at Carluck Manor. We're here to help people reconnect with their health and well-being and revitalize their lives.
Carluck tenants are required to pay at least 30% of their income toward their $700 per month rent. Most units are supplemented by subsidies. In addition, all tenants are required to volunteer 4 hours a month cleaning or doing community service. They also get 3 free meals a day in the on-site cafeteria.
So today we're having a corn chowder and ham and cheese sandwiches.
Carluck is run by Rural Cab, a nonprofit that works to improve the lives of low-income people. One of those people is Leona Hawkinson Crow.
This is where we have our dinner, and everybody comes together, and it's always nice to visit with everybody in here.
Before coming to Carluck, Leona was camping out with a group of homeless people beside the Muldoon Fred Meyer. Leona is one of 8 people who have stopped drinking at Carluck, even though it's allowed.
I haven't had a drink since I've been here.
From Kodiak, Leona's high cheekbones and tawny skin hint at her native heritage. She's Aleutic and Scandinavian. 39 of Carluck's 46 residents claim Alaska Native heritage. The average tenant has tried to get sober 19 times before coming to Carluck. And for most of them, it was their drinking that led to their homelessness, including Leona.
Last time I had a home was in Sitka, and it was about 4 years ago. And I was with my husband, and we both fell off the wagon, and I ended up in treatment in Fairbanks, and before I knew it, I was in and out of homes and shelters and treatment centers for the remainder of 3.5 years to follow that.
The rooms aren't much, just a basic studio with a bathroom, more like a dorm room, really. After several years on the streets of Anchorage, though, to Leona, her room at Carluck seems like a miracle.
When I got here, I couldn't believe what I had, and I was very grateful. One, I was off the street, I was in from the cold, I'm able to take a bath or a shower, and I'm able to lock the door. I'm not afraid to go to bed anymore.
Recent studies of housing first facilities like Carluck show that giving a street alcoholic a home can cut costs. One new study out of Seattle shows that tenants actually reduce their drinking. Susan Collins is a researcher with the University of Washington Harborview. She published the study in the January issue of the peer-reviewed American Journal of Public Health. She and her team tracked tenants' drinking for the study over 2 years to test something she calls the enabling hypothesis.
That's the widely held assumption that allowing alcohol-dependent individuals access to alcohol and not insisting upon 100% abstinence will enable people to drink more and more, and their drinking will eventually spiral out of control.
Collins did her study on a 75-unit Housing First facility in downtown Seattle, where tenants are allowed to drink in their apartments. What she found was a 35% reduction in heavy drinking. A handful of people even quit drinking altogether.
I think the take-home point is that our findings really show that chronically homeless people with alcohol problems are human beings who are very capable of making positive changes in their lives if they're given the same chance as the rest of us. And getting that chance really starts with having a home.
The University of Alaska Anchorage Institute for Circumpolar Health will be conducting their own study of Karluk Manor over the next 2 years, with funding from the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation and the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority. Back at Karluk Manor, Leona says having a home again is helping her get focused on something other than drinking. She's getting in touch with her native heritage through crafts.
And these are what you call spirit pouches. This is made out of cedar and sinew, this one here, and you wear this as a necklace. To me, it makes you feel special.
She says it's important to be emotionally and spiritually fit to make the pouches. And now that she's getting sober, she hopes she'll be making a whole lot more of them. In Anchorage, I'm Daisha Eaton.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, an Alaska organization that offers free legal help to those in need.
There is no real world way a non-lawyer is going to succeed against a well-lawyered team.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Subsistence is a significant part of the lives of many Alaskans. If it's important to you, consider applying for a seat on your local Federal Subsistence Regional Advisory Council. The councils provide vital information to the Federal Subsistence Board on subsistence hunting, trapping, and fishing. The deadline to apply is February 17th. Call 1-800-478-1456 or email subsistence@fws.gov for more information. This message sponsored by U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service.
Alan Moore of Two Rivers was the first musher to reach the halfway point of the Yukon Quest. The first musher to pull into Dawson and then finish the race wins 4 ounces of gold. Moore was followed in closely by Lance Mackey and Hugh Neff early this morning. KUAC's Emily Schwing reports.
At half past midnight, veteran musher Alan Moore pulled up inside the chute in Dawson City. Moore was a little surprised to be the first musher in.
Actually, I think I saw the rest of them. Where did I see them? Somewhere. Someone hollered at me. I thought it might have been Lance. And I wasn't sure. I said, boy, it sounded like him a little bit. You know, I just kept going. So
Lance Mackey had been calling to Moore. They were camped roughly 50 miles north of Dawson. When Hugh Neff came in third, just over an hour after Moore arrived, he helped tell the story.
We were at, Clinton Creek, and Alan won by. That was pretty funny.
Why?
Because Lance was trying to convince him to come in. Didn't think it worked.
But Moore decided not to stop and continued down the Yukon River.
I thought I saw a headlight back about 8 miles, so... It was hard to stay awake until I saw that light. It wasn't after that. And just in case I was first then, if it would have been Lance, I'd been ski-poling quite a bit.
Moore wasn't sure if he had passed Neff and Mackey or if they were still in the lead.
I didn't know where anybody were, where they were, actually. But I kept seeing that I'd seen no sled runner tracks on, the trail. So, So either the snow machine came after them or what happened to them?
Mackey pulled into the checkpoint second, nearly 20 minutes after Alan Moore. He knew he was running behind, but it wasn't until just before he arrived that Mackey realized he wasn't running too far behind.
I left at least an hour behind him at 40 miles, so I didn't even expect to see him. But I just seen his light going across the river right there. I was chewing him up, so... That feels really nice.
Dawson City is 530 miles into a 1,000-mile race course. Arriving first at any checkpoint doesn't decide the outcome of this race. Moore says his strategy hasn't changed.
I mean, there's a lot of good racers in this, and just being first here doesn't mean anything, except for a little bit of gold, I guess.
The weather has started to warm up as teams cross into Canada. It was close to 20 degrees above zero when Alan Moore came in. Lance Mackey says that caused some problems for his dogs.
They're ready for some food. I really screwed up and didn't bring enough for, the warmer the weather, the more food they need. Sounds ridiculous, but it's true. And I didn't bring quite enough, so they suffered for the last 6 hours. So I feel a little guilty. I feel like a rookie.
But they have 36 hours to recover, and warm weather doesn't change Mackey's race plan.
I've been setting myself up to race the second half. And if I had an opportunity to get here without jeopardizing the second half of my race, then I would have done so.
But Hugh Neff might be considering a change in plans after sizing up his competition.
Oh, you know, I definitely seeing Lance take off on me, I realize who's got the team, that's for sure. So I'm just going to play with my team and worry about them.
Neff says he hasn't slept in 4 days. Alan Moore's handlers took lead of his team so he could get some well-deserved rest. And Lance Mackey seemed mostly relieved to have made it halfway through the race.
I am so ready for a nap. I haven't slept a total of 3 hours since we left the starting line. So yeah, I'm as tired as I've ever been in this point of the race.
Reporting on the Yukon Quest Trail in Dawson City, I'm Emily Schwing.
Clinket weaver Terry Rothgar normally works on traditional raven's tail ceremonial pieces using natural wild fibers like mountain goat, buffalo, cedar, and spruce roots. But thanks to a national grant, the Sitka artist will take her weaving in a new direction using high-tech materials like Kevlar and programmable fiber optics. She's calling it her Clinket Superman series. Ann Kaiser has more.
For over 2 decades, Terry Rothgar has been using the same methods of preparing and weaving native regalia as her ancestors some 6,000 years ago. She used to think it was her responsibility to keep this fragile art form alive.
Honestly, I'm the one that's fragile here. It's going to keep going past me.
She says it's always been about using the materials on hand as a way to record the current happenings. But times have changed, and now buyers and collectors drive the market and not the artist.
There's such a stigma of what that art looks like. Even when we go contemporary, many times it's just a spin on or a spoof on the traditional objects that we do.
Recently, Terry found out Creative Capital out of New York City will be funding up to $50,000 towards the completion of 2 new high-tech robes. Of the 1,771 inquiries submitted nationally, her project was just one of 23 that was funded. Sean Elwood is the Director of Grants and Services at Creative Capital and is working closely with Terry on the process.
We also make sure that the artists are getting professional development help so that they're learning more about time management, financial management, how to run their practice as a business, venues that might show the work, people that might write about the work, other funders.
Knowing she'll be financially supported over the course of her project is allowing her a chance to be more adventurous and to step back from making a piece just because it can sell. Now she's free to research new materials being used today and think about how they reflect the world we live in.
And I was working at a cultural center last year, and the Park Service actually let our cultural center go. But I mean, here they are in our community walking around with bulletproof vests, and I'm like, what kind of message does that send? Do I need some bulletproof regalia?
Plus, she thought it would be fun to create a robe rooted in politics, reflecting the era of homeland security.
But the other one, I got wondering, what would a robe look like that is more applicable to the young people? Would it be programmable? They want to link it up to their iPods or their, you know, their MP3 players. Would the colors get brighter as the drums got louder and the singing got louder? Would it change color with the story? Oh, these are all good ideas.
She'd like to experiment with spinning in some aluminum nanofibers, but she has no idea if it's even possible. Other benefits of this particular project are she has the resources for consulting and engineering. Yet it's not enough to create the ideas. There also needs to be an end result, Terry says. And traditionally, robes are made to dance.
With the Kevlar, in my mind, it's a global connection. And the one place that I saw that looked like the best venue for it to come out is called WOW. It's the World Wearable Art Show. It's in Wellington, New Zealand, and they have some really wild performances around the pieces that are accepted within the show. So, I don't know. Maybe it's a haka. I don't know. It's got options.
She can see endless possibilities, but it'll allow the generation that's plugged in to incorporate it into hip-hop and breakdance venues. So with all of this, I had to ask her, just where is the future of traditional regalia going?
Oh, I can't wait to get back to my mountain goat wool. This is just like, oh my, what have I done?
But that won't be for at least 2.5 years, and who knows where this project may lead her. Reporting in Anchorage, I'm Ann Kaiser.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company, and by
Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the Trans-Alaska Pipeline with over 700 employees.
Every Alaskan can make a difference when we file online for our PFD. You can shelter families in crisis, nourish the hungry and homeless, and protect those who have suffered abuse and neglect. And it's easy to share a little of your PFD through Pick, Click, Give. And good things will happen for the causes you care about. This message sponsored by ConocoPhillips Alaska and Mat-Su Health Foundation.
The National Park Service has proposed plowing more of the road into Denali National Park. Park spokeswoman Chris Pfister says keeping more of the road open in winter will allow for better visitor access.
The National Park Service currently plows the road in Denali National Park to Mile 3, which is where park headquarters is. We are looking at a proposal to plow it to Mile 12, which is where the Mountain Vista rest area is, in order to provide better opportunities to come into the park for winter visitors.
Pfister says keeping the additional miles of road open will increase viewing opportunities and provide improved jumping off points for non-motorized backcountry travel. Pfister says the Park Service is looking at impacts of keeping the additional road miles open in winter. Public comments are being accepted through March 9th. Navigating the legal system alone can be daunting for average citizens, but expensive if you must hire a lawyer who starts running the meter with the first call. For lower-income people, it can be impossible to scrape together a retainer, much less pay an hourly fee that can be hundreds per hour. But there are organizations in Alaska that can help. The Northern Justice Project is one such entity, as part of an occasional series on Alaskans who believe in service to others. I spoke with the founders, Jim Davis and Gorian Dedukian, who since 2005 have been assisting Alaskans with civil rights cases. Gorian starts by describing who needs their help.
Most of our clientele are either low-income Alaskans or the working poor who can't afford to pay a lawyer their hourly rate. And we mainly do two types of cases. We do big civil rights cases against the state or the city, like the case we just recently filed, for due process violations, Fair Housing Act violations, and other constitutional violations. And we do some large consumer class actions against debt collectors, hospitals, and other businesses that are taking advantage of Alaskan consumers.
How do you keep the lights on when I'm assuming that a lot of your work is pro bono then? How do you keep yourself in rice and beans?
Well, we first only eat rice and beans, so it's cheap. And we have part-time jobs at another nonprofit agency in the city, so we have like this base income. And the work we do, ultimately, like if you win a civil rights case, for the most part, if you win a civil rights case in the state of Alaska, the court has a discretion to award you attorney's fees. And oftentimes the court will, in our cases. You know, if you lose a case, you don't get paid. If you settle a case, sometimes you don't get paid. But when you actually do a case and you do it to the end and you win, the court can award you attorney's fees. So, you know, we might eat rice and beans for 3 years, and then the fourth year we get an attorney's fees award, and we go out and eat a bunch of steak and drink a bunch of beer and smoke some good cigars, and then the money's gone. We go back to rice and beans.
How important do you think it is that people have legal advice and assistance? In this day and age, can't they research online and represent themselves if they can't afford an attorney?
Well, I think that, you know, as you said, these days a lot of people are representing themselves, mostly because it's so expensive to hire an attorney and they can't afford to hire an attorney. But I would say undeniably that a person is always going to be better off with a skilled attorney than trying to represent themselves. And also the kinds of cases that we do are usually complex cases, a lot of class actions, and involve complicated legal areas. And I don't think the kinds of cases that we do are cases where somebody would be able to represent themselves.
Like Gorian said, if you have an important legal issue, if you have something beyond garden variety, dog bites man, or garden variety divorce, or garden variety, the car I bought broke down and I need it repaired by the dealer. The defendants, the typical defendant, the typical corporate defendant or federal defendant or state defendant has a good team of lawyers representing it. And there is no real world way a non-lawyer is going to succeed against a well-lawyered team. Without a good lawyer on your side, you're just not going to make it through the navigation. You'll never even get to the judge to have the judge hear your dispute, because you'll be knocked out in 50 different ways by the team of lawyers that knows all the tricks to keep you from ever getting to the judge.
At the end of the day, I know that there is a perception by some folks of the kind of attorney that you mentioned that is out eating steaks and smoking big cigars. And why do this when you could make money in private practice or with a for-profit firm? Why are you doing this type of work that obviously doesn't keep you in steaks and big cigars every week?
Well, both Gorian and I did the, when we got out of law school, we both sampled the big firm life where, you know, we got paid high salaries and got all the perks, catered dinners, whenever you work past 6 o'clock and all that stuff. It just wasn't a fulfilling life. I mean, getting paid a lot of money and having a driver pick us up after work or take us to the courthouse, it was all kind of nice, but it just wasn't a fulfilling life. And it just didn't seem I was serving anybody. I kind of believe that Bob Dylan line, you got to serve somebody. Anyways, so to me, there was no choice. And when I stopped working as a corporate lawyer a couple of years into my legal career and started working for the people, as I say, or people that needed legal assistance and not just corporations, it was like a light went off in my head. I just knew this is what I was going to do. It didn't matter what the financial reward was. You know, ultimately, at the end of the day, almost every day, I think, you know, Gorian and I leave work late, but pretty happy with what we've done.
Jim Davis and Gorian Dedukian are civil rights attorneys and the founders of the Anchorage-based Northern Justice Project. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Alexandra Gutierrez in Unalaska, Daisha Eaton and Ann Kaiser in Anchorage, Emily Schwing on the Yukon Quest Trail, and Dan Bross in Fairbanks. APRN's Dave Donaldson reported from Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
the statewide BP Teachers of Excellence Program. Nomination forms are available at bpteachers.com. Nominations are due by February 14th.
And by
Rasmussen Foundation, accepting online nominations for the 2012 Distinguished Artist Award until March 1st. Learn more at rasmussen.org.
The State of Alaska Department of Revenue reminds you to file online now for your 2012 PFD and consider sharing a portion of your dividend through Pick, Click, Give or contributing to a college savings plan. More information at pfd.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the State of Alaska.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.